It is live. This whole podcast thing, this thing that we do called the Lean Into Art Cast with Jersey Drozd.
That's me.
Yep.
And to my right is star of stage and screen and also the author of many books, Mr. Bennett Cerf. That's me being faux intellectual by referring to somebody who was well known in the literary circles in the 50s, and actually referring to the video, the game show from the 50s, What's My Line? So, not really clever. Yeah, I watched the Game Show Network, and really, that's Rob Stenzinger over there.
Cool. I don't have the Game Show Network.
I don't either. I used to years ago, and I got obsessed with watching 50s game shows. What's My Line? Beat the Clock. The Name's the Same. You can find them on YouTube. I wound up making VCDs of the shows and record them on my computer and rip them to CDs afterwards, or burn them to CDs.
Yeah, the VCD format, long may it live. Actually, I would bet you're all set probably because of things like VLC. Yep. You should be okay to watch that still.
Yeah, but it doesn't look very good. It was recorded at 320 by 240 resolution. Ooh, not so hot on a nice computer monitor or on a HD TV. I'll tell you what. But hey, it was 1950s television. The video quality wasn't that good from the source material. So, but you know what? If they put out DVD collections of The Name's the Same, What's My Line, and Beat the Clock, I would totally buy them.
Wow, what is it about them? What is it?
Well, you know what the gimmick of What's My Line is, right? Or no?
It's escaping me.
Okay. It's, there's a panel of celebrity, judge or celebrity contestants, right? Mm-hmm. So you got Bennett Cerf and you've got, I'm forgetting everybody else's names now because I'm all looped up on cold medicine. But anyway, like famous people from the 50s. Okay.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Then they bring in a person who we don't know and we give them the name, and the panelists get 20 questions to ask them, and it has to be a yes or no question in order to guess what their job is. And so they bring in, and they always bring in these zinger guests where it's like this pretty petite blonde, and she's like a gorilla hunter, you know. And it's does your job involve a service of some sort? Yes, you know. And they have to whittle it down until they get to what it is, right?
Cool. So yeah, it's like a themed version of 20 questions.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Beat the Clock is sort of like The Price is Right, but with like really potentially dangerous stunts that people have to do. You know, it's like, but really.
Probably low budget ones. Like, I bet it's like tie your shoe while standing on one foot and on a chair while someone shakes it.
Yeah, yeah. And or like you got to hold this funnel in your mouth while your wife pours like gallons of whipped cream into it, and you can't, you know. You have to go for 30 seconds or something like that. So it's just silly, boisterous kind of fun TV shows. But it has a very 50s feel to it too, where they'll break into a commercial in the middle of the show, start talking about Swanson's chicken dinners, you know? And it's before that 70s kind of sleaze happened with like Gene Rayburn and like and Richard Dawson like kissing women on the lips when they were
Martindale. Oh gosh, yeah, the whole weird sexism thing and the
on the Family Feud, like what's his name, Richard Dawson would always kiss the women on the lips.
And, yeah, he would.
And like, think about that today in today's context, like, whoa, what is that, you know? And it was okay to make a comment about their looks and everything. Whoa. So anyway, yeah. Highly recommend What's My Line. I love that show with all my heart. And I did not mean to go on such a long tangent about it. So, Rob.
Yeah.
Rob, I lost control. I lost control when I was talking about The Name's the Same and What's My Line. And I think it's due to this cold medication I'm on. But I'm wondering if you can help me wrap my brain around this idea of why I lose control and why that upsets me so much, and how can I get control of myself?
I've been waiting for you to be quiet, and frankly, because I want to get the reins of this podcast. I've got things to say, Jersey.
Wait a second. There's one more thing I wanted to say about Wink Martindale.
No. You need to give the stage to me now. I'm sorry.
I think you neglected to see whose name goes first on the artist listing of this podcast episode. That's
exactly.
Right. This kid. Until you start editing shows and putting them on the internet, then you can put your name first. But until then, my name's first, which means I, at the conch shell, I get to talk as long as I want to.
All right.
There was a little. There was our modeling exercise.
Exactly. And yeah, too much giggling to make it seem realistic. But it's fun to actually do a little bit of role playing to get a little bit of the idea. And at least, even though if you're totally BSing it, like try to think, well, what leads to that kind of mindset? Taking a step back, what we're talking about is something that came up during the design series, control and wanting to having to work with that as, I mean, I suppose as designers or in anything that we do, we personally may have certain topics that we feel really strongly about and have a hard time being flexible. And I think it's all about that friction of when you need to work with someone else, or there's a factor outside of you. Because even if you're working with yourself, there may be something that isn't as changeable as you'd prefer, right? And so you could run into control problems. And we wanted to talk about that today.
I'm pleased with where I am these days with my level of, or my response to a controlling situation. I think I'm a lot better today than I used to be. But that said, I still had an experience not a week ago where I made a mental note of, Durs, you handled that badly. I felt myself behave in a way that I knew I was operating out of a sense of anger and petulance and aggrievement. I felt aggrieved by something that was happening, and my response came from that, not from responding to the situation in like a flexible, level-headed manner like I try to. And of course, when I made a mental note of that, the first thing that happened was I felt guilty immediately. I felt really bad about behaving. I'm like, oh God, Jers, you're going to be that guy forever. You did that in public. You're going to be that guy forever who gets all petulant and pouty when something happens that challenges your authority or your presence or your contribution to a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I immediately cut that off at the pass. I was like, no, you don't. No, you don't. You are not going to pout even more. Not on my watch. You're not going to do this. You're going to look at what you did. You're going to identify it. And you're going to say, this is what I'm going to do to not do that again. And so in thinking about it, I realized that the reason I acted so, the reason I pouted and said some kind of aggressive things, but I did it with a smile on my face. And I don't think anybody picked up on the fact that I was angry. Probably only I knew I was angry. But I think it came out of the fact that I was afraid. I was afraid of losing control of the situation, in the sense that somebody looked like they had more of a right to do something than I did. And it's not that I want to decide who lives and who dies. It's just that I feel like I've made enough of a contribution in the fields that I have tried to contribute to that I don't have to justify it to anybody. I don't have to do the whole standing on top of the pile and pound my chest to prove what a great guy I am for doing this. It's evident. Look around you. It's evident that I did some stuff. And if I want to talk about this stuff, I kind of have a right to. And there was a situation where another person was kind of passive aggressively trying to challenge that. And I felt myself, and I think it came out of, this is where psychology comes in. I think it came out of my past. I think it came out of past relationships where I've dealt with some very seriously passive aggressive people, and it pushed a old trigger button that hasn't been set off in a long time, you know? I'm sure that happens to everybody.
Yeah, totally.
But the thing was, is that I felt the situation slipping out of my fingers, and I didn't have control of my own reactions to it, right? So, like, I think about my early teaching days. And I've been in classrooms where I've literally had a child, a 9-year-old, write on a piece of paper, F-U, put it face down and pass it towards me. And then I pick it up and look at it and it says that, and the kids all laugh at me.
No.
And that, you know, that's a situation where you have no control over the room whatsoever, right?
Right.
And in my early days in working with these kinds of groups, I remember getting like kind of aggressive towards them. Like, hey, come on, knock it off. Got to stay on task here.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the years went on and as I got some really awesome training from some teaching friends, I learned that, no, you do jujitsu with that stuff. You use their energy against them. And if they want to be a big show-off, let them be a show-off at the front of the room. Let them put on a show, that kind of thing. And we've talked about this before. But that's a different kind of control, right? That's a more nuanced kind of control. And once I learned to do that kind of thing, it helped me a lot in my working with others, where I realized that when somebody is trying to take control of a situation, it can often come across as being aggression, right? And it becomes a challenge to your sense of control. Are you going to counter it with an equal snarl? You're both fighting over the bone. Or are you going to try to roll with it and use their energy to make them feel like they're in control so that they'll calm down and then you can get something done? And this isn't about manipulating people. This is about like...
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. My agenda, I had like three things I was going to tell people how they always get their way. What's the podcast about, man?
The art of war.
No. It's interesting. I hear a few different...
I know. I just buckshot you again, Rob. I'm sorry I always do that.
You concretize a bunch of different things about control. I think it'd be worth unwrapping a little bit. So you've got, I'm just theorizing off the cuff, but maybe there's areas of concern of control, or maybe the different domains. Like there's sort of control over sort of yourself, someone else's control over you, or maybe the situation or the goal that you're sharing, or resources that you're sharing and having to deal with in the situation. And I think each of your stories highlighted different sort of control zones that you're trying to you'd have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and we should back up and also say that this topic kind of came out of the fact that we were really talking about in the design series, just go back, you know, three episodes, or five if you want. It was the episode before this was the final episode of the design series, okay? And we were doing them every other episode as a video show. They were good, too, I have to say. I thought we did a good job. We were talking about the difference between designing for yourself versus designing for others, or designing by yourself versus designing with a group. And one of the big distinguishing features that changes between those two or four scenarios is your level of control in the situation, right?
Yep.
So, like, for instance, I worked in a graphic design department at a real estate magazine back in like 2000, 2001, and I was the lead designer, in air quotes, with another designer working in air quotes under me. He wasn't really, he was getting paid the same salary, you know. I didn't really have the authority to do anything about his behavior, so I didn't have a lot of control over what kind of output we had in this department, right? It was kind of on both of us. And should my coworker decide that he didn't want to have the output that day that I had, it just sort of fell on to me to take it on, or vice versa for that matter, you know. There was no sense of tight control in that situation. It was more of like we had to constantly negotiate what was going on in that room.
Right.
Whereas when later on I got a job as a corporate graphic designer for a health organization, and I had my own office, I was by myself, there was nobody else in my department, I was essentially my own boss, I was salaried, so I didn't have to punch in or punch out. I had an immense amount of control over my situation there. So, yeah. That's one of those like on the ground distinguishing features of how control changes. But I don't know which aspect sounds more interesting to you to attack first, like, you know, control over the environment, control over the product, control over yourself.
I suppose it's a let's say we're going, I don't know, I'm guessing right now that we're going to assume control over ourselves.
Right.
And because if you're listening to this kind of podcast, you find this pretty fascinating. You're probably set in that area.
Yeah.
But I think an interesting area to tackle would be the creative input, that kind of control, because that's the shared reason you care about the outcome, and maybe that's a little bit of a probably the focus of what we're talking about. And I've always heard that as a quoted as a job satisfaction kind of thing too, where if you have a job that allows for creative input, some amount of agency, so choice over the agenda, where you put your time and the kind of results that you're trying to seek and whatnot. I think that gets into that that creative territory of, well, we're trying to make something for ourselves or someone else. And there's factors, things that come up now in dealing with it. Things like people have different opinions on what it should be or how it can be done, yeah, or even when. But I don't know. Then again, I'm starting to argue against myself a little bit. So maybe it's just a big old bowl of control.
Well, I mean, no, I mean, I think having a say in something means that is another way of saying that is that you have skin in the game, right? Mm-hmm. Where you are a participant in something rather than just going along with something. You're not a follower. You're a co-leader in something because you've gotten to throw in your two cents. Gosh, as somebody who's worked with a lot of groups, I mean, I can't underscore enough how important that is for everybody to feel like they have a say. If you don't, then I don't think that the reverse effect of that is to necessarily feel fear, but more feel apathy, right? It's like you're just kind of
get disconnected, exactly.
Yeah,
and sort of be very passive, like, well, whatever you guys do,
yep,
whatever I say doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay. So, how about I jump into an example and let's see what comes of that.
Yeah.
So I've been involved in designing user interfaces for software for many years now. And it's, I guess in any sort of visual design discipline, people who see the product will have different opinions and maybe different criteria, like maybe they've used an application on one platform and are using these ideas to play a certain game and really loved a certain sound effect or how the HUD popped up on something and think, well, gosh, that should inform this business form application. And I think it's possible. This is revealing of my relationship with control. I believe it's possible that any of that may have a valid hook or be able to guide us to some kind of shared idea. And so how I look at it is I'll have a lot of constituents, people with skin in the game toward this end product, including myself. And I'll have my own idea of I want to be a part of this team that's making, well, the best thing that we can make and make sure that it's serving the people that we're trying to serve in the best way possible. But of course, we need to quantify all that besting, right? Otherwise, I know one way to start tossing around control is to sort of sound grand and important and boisterous about all these different choices. And so people may just roll with it, right? That's one way.
Yeah. There's other ways to think about it too that I want to get to because, yeah, you're getting into an area where you're beginning to encroach on stepping on my toes about the way I behave in meetings because I tend to do a lot of boisterous talking in meetings.
But I don't think that's a bad thing though too because it helps... I think people need catalysts.
I'm not defensive, by the way. It's just I think it's an opportunity for some discussion to like fully digest the concept. But
yeah, well, it's very much that kung fu could be used to build or destroy, basically. It's
But I want to ask you something. Open source software philosophy that really has affected you deeply, hasn't it? That's what I'm hearing in your voice right now when you're talking about how being open to other people's contributions to a bigger thing, right?
Maybe. For me, it's partially, I've adopted this strategy partially out of trying to survive in the happiest way I can. I mean,
it's a coping mechanism.
In part.
So people don't run roughshod all over you, or at least you don't notice it as much.
It's that's a way where I guess all of this could be used toward a positive or not as positive end. Because so my approach is I'm an advocate for everyone to an extent. So I want to make sure that as much information is brought to bear to not be passive and avoid making a decision, but to help facilitate a decision that is clearly woven together of all these different opinions.
Right.
So I try to externalize the opinions and then piece them together in a very visual and audible manner for everyone to see in a very transparent way. So but it's definitely affected by my experience to open source. I mean, I've already waved the Ubuntu flag before.
But let's get at what you just described there. You were describing something where that's a nuanced, high level, very attentive form of control over a situation rather than a blunt commandeering kind of control. I'm the leader. You shut up, listen to me. This is the way we're going to do it. Your kind of control is more of a kind of Taoist Aikido kind of way of let's give everybody a say. And then I'm going to do my best while I'm listening to you to knit all of your ideas together into some kind of cohesive gel here that we can vote on and we can all come to some kind of agreement about.
Exactly. And as I do the knitting, without a doubt, this is where I am using my voice and expertise. I will try to do some shaping to try to make it be the best result it can. Sort of like when you hear someone say, I want to make a cool comic that has this this person on their way to school, but they're so happy, but they realize they forgot the main thing that they were so happy about that they were going to bring to school and whatever. But they're blurting out these ideas. And if they come to you with that, you're probably going to help channel it toward a result that will end in a real comic, right?
Right.
And that kind of channeling that's what I use to guide that sort of approach. So I'm definitely trying to exert some kind of creative input and have an effect on the outcome. It's not just sort of gathering the random data and it's a big pile of data at the end.
But to all but the most observant person, that's an invisible thing you're doing, right? And it's often a very thankless thing that you're doing. I mean, the satisfaction better come from within on that kind of thing, because nobody's going to give you an award for being a really good facilitator, you know?
Yeah, true. People might have fun and invite you back kind of thing, but it's typically a...
No, but it becomes more of a squishy, fuzzy thing where there's like, I always have good feelings about Rob for some reason, but I can't pin down what it is. I always just feel better after being around that guy. You know what I mean? I mean, I run into this all the time because I try to do the same thing and I don't always succeed. But in my classroom experiences, that is what I'm doing is I'm dealing with a lot of kids who are scared to do the challenging things I'm putting in ahead of them. And so I start talking them through it. And then I am pointing them at the fact that these are your ideas. All I'm doing is just comparing them kind of like with Lego blocks and going, oh, these don't fit. These don't fit. Oh, these fit.
Exactly.
And then when we're done, I congratulate them. Look at what she did. Look at what she did today, everybody. And then everybody gives her a round of applause, you know? So they're not going to walk away from that going like, oh, he was a great teacher because he helped me find that creative path through listening to me and regurgitating my ideas back at me in new ways to get me to think about them differently. Right. So it can be a very thankless job. That's all I was trying to say.
But, it totally. Especially when non-disclosure agreements are all involved and you can't even talk about what you're making.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Or even when you're working in like different organizations for your day job and you can't talk out of school because it's unethical, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when I say talking out of school, in some ways I'm being quite literal.
Yeah, good point.
But there's also this sense of, like, when you start talking about agency, there's also the danger of negotiating with groups and working with groups of people is if people in the group don't feel like they're actually contributing in any kind of meaningful way, that's a form of loss of control where they'll get very antsy. And I've had this happen in the past with working with groups where someone will become resentful because they don't feel like they have an active hand in the decision-making process and the execution of something. And it wasn't that the group didn't want them to. It's just that for whatever reason, the dynamics of the room added up to them not being volunteered or elected to do something. And
yeah, and it kind of, yeah, absolutely. That can come from people, their experiences prior to being in that room. And it can come from just having a more dominating personality among the group or a couple that end up quieting the other voices. One of the helpful ways to deal with that is to be a moderator and try to assist and sort of pass the mic kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when that doesn't work, because that's just too much in the territory of the more dominating personalities, well, then I'll try to do some kind of voting mechanism. So then literally everyone gets the votes. One really helpful way to do that is let's do some kind of dot voting or post-it notes, and you try to capture ideas and then go through different phases, but through an orchestrated mechanism like that. So it's harder for someone to overwrite what everyone else is trying to express.
You know, I'm anticipating that somebody listening is going to be saying at this point, what's this got to do with art? What's this got to do with visual storytelling? And I'm gonna try to tie it in by talking about or identifying what you don't do, Rob, when you're doing this, what you're not doing. Gosh, we live in a world of so many extremists where people are either, you know, you're either black or you're white, you're A or you're B. You're either in full control or you're not controlling at all, right? So like if somebody like, oh man, we talked about this in a past Lean Into Art where I was concerned that a teacher looking into my classroom is going to think I'm not really doing anything when what I'm doing is, in my opinion, very sophisticated and exhausting. I made myself sick this week teaching.
And wouldn't that be a funny compliment? I worked so hard in your class, you made me sick.
But I loved every minute of it.
Cool.
So like somebody could easily think that, oh, well, you're talking about your role as a facilitator. You're just kind of letting everybody talk and then saying, okay, let's vote. Boy, that's exactly a lot different.
Letting everybody say
is like passing the mic around the room and saying, and then like Joe over here says, I like hamburgers, and then he passes the mic. Okay, well, what's that got to do with this car we're building, you know? That's where the moderator, the facilitator comes in to knit these ideas together, right? And sometimes you got to do that. Sometimes you got a nut that's in there that says, and I like hamburgers, and you got to go, okay, how do I honor this and knit it back into the discussion? Now, what I want to drive this towards, what does this got to do with being a visual storyteller? Well, we're talking about collaboration here right now. We're talking about the kinds of loss of control that can happen when you're working with somebody else. And there's a lot of out-of-the-can advice about this. Be respectful. Listen to your collaborator. Respect their opinions. Oh, it's a 50-50 split. You know what? It's my opinion that it's not always a 50-50 split. Sometimes it oscillates between 70-30, 80-20, and then it oscillates back to 20-80. It goes back and forth, and it's not always a 50-50 split. It's not that cut and dry, and it's not just as easy as popping open that can of respect and listen, and it's just going to be a great collaboration, right? There's got to be some kind of dynamics. There's got to be some tension, and those kinds of dynamics and tension need to be negotiated and navigated through, and understanding why we want control and what makes us get uptight about control and what makes us not uptight about control is a worthwhile thinking exercise. There, I made my case.
Sure. Yeah. There's a difference between a valid exchange of ideas than just going through certain motions like reflective listening. And
oh, here, I'll do reflective listening. So Rob, just keep going for a second.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what we want to do with this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That is not reflective listening.
No, it's not. So what I heard you say, Jersey, is that what I was doing wasn't reflective listening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What I did was reflective listening.
No, but
even using that technique, it's helpful to learn that kind of stuff. But if it's not building toward some kind of shared outcome you care about, then yeah, that's not going to get anyone anywhere either.
No. No, it's not. And I just wanted to make sure that we underlined the distinction between understanding the need to, when it's important to take control, when it's important to relinquish control, and that those are, they are both equally valid options, and they are both equally valid options at certain times. They are by no means a definitive absolute that work for every situation, right? And it's not about just taking your hands off the wheel saying no point in steering now. You know, it's
exactly. About, hope one of you guys grabs this.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to really, be hurt pretty on. Quick.
Because if this plane goes down, they're going to blame you guys, not me. I don't care. You know?
Well, I've got a counter example to that where I do exert far more control.
Okay.
And I think this is common for a lot of different visual storytellers is sometimes you come across either the, sometimes clients don't know what they want and they don't know what they don't know yet. And one of the reasons they involve you is to, they know enough of that. Well, we need this expertise. We need that kind of magic. Okay, well, let's start dealing with this kind of person. And once in a while, it's, you'll have to just make things up. And I try to do what I try to go through different analytical and storytelling skills and all that kind of stuff and try to understand their business and goals and all that kind of thing. But, and to make some kind of informed product of whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, a lot of times it's mock-ups of software and I may have, and I actually, well, I'll be very transparent about it and say like, this has like 80% baloney in it. You know, I may be a vegetarian or pescatarian, but I use a lot of baloney in, in my day job from time to time.
You know, asking, well, what do you think can be just as much hiding behind what looks like careful negotiating skills when you really are not taking your due control of a situation, right? Sometimes you're there because your expertise is needed and you need to step up and accept the fact that your expertise is what is required in the situation. And just saying, well, I don't know, what do you think? Doesn't make you a thoughtful person, right?
Gosh.
There's a time and place for that sentence. And I've been in situations where somebody who was supposed to be in the lead pulled that number on me, and that was their way of dodging the where the buck stops, right? And so then if somebody else gets to say, well, I think this, all right, then that's what we're going to do, and therefore it's your fault that this thing fails, right?
What's funny is I get frustrated with that approach, and anytime I get frustrated with something, I step back and think, well, you know, pros and cons of this. Why is this there? And, you know, I get all, you know, trying to, you know, contemplate what is occurring and why is that so frustrating. And I think maybe it just depends on the motivation of who's doing that. And like, I can get really sympathetic with that kind of person when it's like, oh, they saw a good workshop. And so they saw some things get facilitated and they're trying to do that. Cool. People need to practice, right? You know what? I've been, what do you think, guy? Okay. I forgive you. What?
I'm writing that one down. That's another possible t-shirt. Hey, we've all been, what do you think, guy?
Okay. And at the same time, malicious, what do you think, guy? Maybe like if I ever, perhaps that's my arch nemesis, where willfully passive, trying to avoid action, because one thing that's awesome about when people care enough to have the desire to control is if they all are there to get that thing done.
Yeah.
And so that, then you know what? It's possible to find a compatible way to work together, to share the control.
One of the things that comes out of that, the what do you think guy too, that I think is really interesting to explore as far as psychology is, I feel like often it comes out of the sense that they don't want to admit that they don't know something, that they don't know how to handle something. And if they say, what do you think? Then they look like they're a facilitator and they're guiding their troops when, as if there's something dishonorable about saying, you know what? You're going to have to say that again because I did not understand what you just said. Could you say that with different words? Could you say that slower? Could you just repeat it? Because I didn't pick up, or I don't even know what you're referring to. There's nothing wrong with that. And I can tell you, as somebody who's taught in a lot of classrooms, when the kids mention something that I don't know about, they let me off the hook when I go, what's that? You know, they don't suddenly say, oh, you don't have any authority in this room anymore. You know, so why can't a leader do that? Why can't somebody?
I love it so much when anyone in a room, especially especially when a leader comes in and says, wow, that was, I don't know if you knew this, Jersey, but sometimes I'm a little abstract.
I've heard.
And I love it so much when someone actually will say, okay, I kind of got some of what you were putting out there, but this really, you know, can you dive a little deeper, hit that from a different angle? I didn't follow you, or I'm not understanding, or.
You get lit up when that happens, right? It's like, cool.
I fall in love a little bit when that happens.
They want to know. They want to know what you meant. And they're not just going, yeah, you know? So I think that again, we're talking about a fear of looking foolish in the eyes of others, informing your behavior, right?
Yep.
So yeah, I'm the same way. Talking about my teaching friend Mary Jo, who's going to become this legendary figure on all these Lean Into Heart podcasts we talk about. One of these days, I'll get her on one of my shows. But whenever she doesn't know what you're talking about, she has this beaming, just engaging smile. She's just, everything about her look says, I want to wrap my brain around you right now. And she says, I don't know anything about that. Tell me about it. You know, so and sometimes it would catch me off guard because like I'd say something about Transformers or something. She's like, Transformers, I've heard of that, but I don't know what it is. Tell me about it. I'm like, I'm not going to tell you about the Transformers. it's just a stupid, nerdy thing that I like. And you're not going to be interested. I guarantee it, you know. But
that is the coolest.
But yet she wants to know. She wants to understand what you're talking about, what you're referring to, you know. I hang out with this group of guys in the Ann Arbor area, all these local, what they self-identify themselves as geeks. They're all people from different fields, photography, computer science, engineering. And we get together for coffee once a week. And one of the reasons I knew I genuinely loved being around these guys is they talk pop culture like anybody else does. And they're talking about Star Wars and other movies and TV shows. And one of them mentioned something that I never heard of. And I didn't want to interrupt the flow to go, what are you talking about? Because I felt like it was just trivial enough that I was going to halt the flow of what was a fun time by going, hey, wait, explain. So I just kind of went, ha, like that, you know. And one of the guys looks at me and he goes, do you not know what we're talking about? And I said, no, not really. And then they explained it to me. Instead of it becoming this, oh, you hear that, everybody? Jersey doesn't know. Hey, Jersey doesn't know. Jersey doesn't know. Right? The kind of high school thing that happens all the time. They wanted me to know, and they were, you know, they were watching me and being attentive to whether or not I felt engaged, even in a social setting. That's being an adult is what it is.
Yeah. That's an interesting example of another style of control at a group setting, where some groups want to have, that exclusiveness, and maybe control over, I don't know, feeling better about themselves versus others or whatever.
Right.
And, but then others are just totally, just so much more welcoming. And, have you ever run into that in a creative project? Like, have you ever, like, I suppose it'd be maybe not good to go too specific regarding anything you're making with them. Right. But
right.
Like,
yeah. How about I just do this? I don't want to talk about any specific project. I'll just talk about people that I've known. And yeah, I have known my share of people. I'm in a blessed state right now where I think the majority of people in my life do not do this. But for a long time, throughout my teens and my 20s, I was surrounded by people who were very much into creating the illusion of control through being exclusive. Mm. You can't come in. And as long as I keep pushing X people out, then I've got the lid on things. I've got things under my thumb. I know where I'm going and what I'm doing because I'm not that guy. And you know, when I was younger, I never knew what it was about that really rubbed me the wrong way, that really kind of pushed me up. It made me very uncomfortable and often made me feel really aggressive and angry. I mean, believe it or not, I was in my late teens through my early 20s. I was a very angry young man.
That means you were a young man.
What? Yeah. Well, angry for me. I mean, yeah. I mean, like, probably not compared to most guys, but I was considerably angrier back then than I am now. And I think part of that was informed by that discomfort that I had but from the people I was surrounded by. And I think that this is an interesting one, too, is that an unhealthy desire for control can lead to some really problematic behavior. What?
Sorry, what are you laughing at? You reminded me of something. I'm not even like, I really should turn this into a comic. But no, finish your thought. I'll come back to it.
Are you sure? Because we've done this before and you've forgotten what you were going to bring up. So let's just hear it now.
Old man, Rob. You reminded me of something when I was in my teens. And let's see. I went to this. I don't know why I was really that curious about it in the first place, but it was a thing called, an activity called Junior Achievement, right?
Okay.
And so it's kind of like a DECA thing. Basically, you form a real and or mock business, and you establish roles and, you know, make a product and market it and all that kind of stuff. And I was just super curious about it. And so I went, and the first day of class, we got this outline of, well, here's what your Junior Achievement is and all that. And it was an after school thing. And next week we're going to vote for who our board members are and who's the president and everything. So I'm like, okay, cool. Now this is Rob, of age 16, full on leather jacket with, you know, heavy metal,
fingernails long, shaved to points.
Not quite that. No, not that. But you know, yeah, I had about, you know, an Iron Maiden shirt for almost every day of the month. And anyway, but so I was in normal Rob attire, whatever. This was my thing, and I guess I always enjoyed that, being in sort of the geek, the advanced classes, yet being a metalhead, whatever. always, I come in with low managing people's expectations to the low side. Anyway, so the second day, people, you know, showed up and tried to, you know, make their case for the different roles that they wanted, and the main one was the president. I showed up in a suit, and nobody had seen me in a suit, like, ever. And I got up and I spoke passionately and eloquently about, I just want to do the best I can and serve the group to make sure that we're getting the most out of this experience and we create a cool product and have fun while we do it. And that was my speech. And then the other person's speech, this is what I have to do, is surf my memories, because I'm going to not do it justice. But this young gentleman said the word control. Like, I've always wanted to control, et cetera. And then when I control, et cetera, and when you are on my staff, I will control, et cetera. And then, like, he just kept using the word control. Oh, and wow. People were creeped out by
wow.
that.
Wow.
And then there was a really smart, really smart, cool, perky girl that probably should have won, but I won.
Because you got him with the wow factor with coming in a suit, and they were like,
oh, I got him with the wow. And, and I was passionate and I wanted, you know, do my best for everybody kind of thing. And yeah.
So you went the John F. Kennedy route, and that second gentleman went the George Bush Jr. route. what was the other guy? The power behind the power.
Cheney?
Cheney, thank you. The guy who shot his friend's face. Not making any political statement there.
No, but that's yeah.
That's anyway, but yeah. Why did I remind you of that when I was talking about being exclusive?
Just control. That poor kid. And he's always going to be in my memory of who knows? He might have been a decent leader, but boy, did you know, he probably needed to sort some things out first.
Did he have shark eyes? Did he just have that glassy black stare of a shark as he looked out upon everybody?
he did have a darkness about him, an aura. Anyway, sorry about that.
No, that was a funny story, actually. That's terrifying. But yeah, I think about how an unhealthy desire for control, which is probably what keyed in that memory of that shark-eyed, nightmarish kid, it can lead you to be exclusive, to create exclusion where exclusion isn't necessary, right? Mm. So I have developed as a knee-jerk reaction to that whole period of my life to be extremely inclusive, possibly sometimes to a fault. But my attitude is that I want everybody to feel like they got something out of my classroom experience, right? I don't want anybody on Twitter to feel like I gave them a cold shoulder, unless they're being a jerk to me, right? And then at that point, I give them a second chance. I'll follow up and say, "Are you sure you didn't mean this?" And if they're still being a jerk, okay, then I'm done with you, you know. But
very fair, yeah.
But I mean, and I think. And having struggled with this kind of stuff myself, having struggled with, like I was just mentioning at the top of this one, when I acted petulant towards somebody, it came out of them pushing this old rusty, player one button on me, to make me feel like I'm going to walk out of this room shamed unless I respond with the right retort. And in reflection, what I think was the right response would be to let it just slide down my back. Because if you have a sense of, if you are self-possessed, if you own yourself, there's nothing that somebody can lob at you that can really make you feel demeaned, right? They can throw all sorts of insults at you and you can just be like, "Are you done? Really? Is that it? Okay. Well, I'm going to go back and do the work now and I'll see you later, you know?"
Yeah, it's tough though. I mean, that's kind of like prioritizing caring about the outcome more than maybe personal hangups or fear.
Well, there you go. And that's a different kind of control, right? You're talking in like a long-term intangible kind of sense of control over a situation and a control over yourself, which, oh, back me up on this, Rob. When you get through a situation when you actually did control yourself, that feels mighty good, even if nobody was watching.
Oh, sure. Yeah. My batteries are powered by my intense sense of self-satisfaction.
Right.
Over lots of different choices and challenges like that.
But I'll tell you, when I was in my 20s, though, I fought with this a lot. In my 20s, I felt so ripped off that I didn't have the television audience watching me when I did something good and nobody saw it. You know, it's like you watch things like The Wonder Years and Different Strokes, all these TV shows where like the good character does something good and he's not thanked for it or she's not thanked for it. And the other characters go on their way and their lives are all fixed now because this one kid did the good thing. But we know, the audience knows, we know. So we're with you, Gary Coleman. We know that you did the right thing. I was so angry when I was like 19, 20, 21, that where is my audience that is thanking or is like, you know, quietly congratulating me for doing the right thing in the situation, you know? That's another thing that you got to kind of pick up later on, I guess, or unless you're like born with it.
It's called a wife. Or husband or life partner. Or
life partner, spouse. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, depending on what state you live in.
Yeah. And so, yeah, exactly. I'm not saying that as any judgment. That could be any combo of couple.
I think people
totally
pick
awesome.
That up from us already.
Yeah, exactly.
We're both Hufflepuffs here. We're well-rounded guys. But anyway, where was it going with that? I got lost on that one. And there's where the cold medicine is actually kicking in. This sense of... controlling yourself in the moment is related to a control of what the desired outcome is and having a sense of what the desired outcome of any situation is. When you are confronted with a differing of opinion or a challenging personality or a challenging situation in a project, we can instantly go back to that lizard brain thing of feeling like fear. I'm going to lose the job. I'm going to lose my position in the organization. People are going to call me out as a fraud when they see what work I put into this thing. And you know what? Okay, here's where I'm going to back up, and I'm going to talk about cartoons for a second.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that maybe a lot of people have heard of the Saturday Supercast, the show that I do irregularly over at sugarcereals.com. In that series of podcasts, we did a breakdown of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, the 80s cartoon series.
Was that two or three episodes?
Two.
Yeah.
and I can't remember which part it was, but I'm actually very proud of the discussions that we had in those two episodes. So it's worth listening to both if you really dig listening to me nerdily dissect the storytelling of a beloved 80s cartoon franchise.
Well, but you could just stop right there and say nerdily dissect storytelling. Yeah. And yeah, it's a great series.
But in there, I made this case that the Adam He-Man dichotomy represents something that I'm pretty sure the writers didn't mean, but I pick up on it and I think it's there, is that, okay, so you got Prince Adam, wimpy guy, purple tights, salmon colored vest, nerdy voice, kind of a bumbler, the king, his father, the king doesn't even really respect him. His father's always saying things like, I wish you would act more like a prince. Teela, the captain of the Royal Guard, female captain of the Royal Guard, is always picking on him, saying, like, you need to train. I'm your bodyguard. You shouldn't need a bodyguard, you know? But when he raises that sword and says, by the power of Grayskull, boom, now he's the most powerful man in the universe. He's the most capable man in the universe. Well, then why not just stay He-Man all the time? Because if he stayed He-Man all the time, he'd be a monster. He-Man is us at our best, at our very best. And we have to also be the fool. We also have to be the bungler. This is a Taoist principle of do the work and then let it go and let people think you're an idiot. Because that is what makes us human is our flaws. What makes us lovable are our flaws. And if we don't accept the fact and embrace the fact that we have flaws and relinquish that control and let ourselves look foolish every once in a while, we become an inhuman monster. And that is exactly what He-Man would be. And especially with the character of Cringer, now I know I'm getting really nerdy here, so people you can throw tomatoes at me on the streets after you hear me say this. Cringer is a great reflection of that philosophy in that Cringer doesn't like to become Battle Cat. Cringer is there to show us that it's okay and even desirable to be the bumbling human being. He hates being Battle Cat. He hates getting turned into that creature. And even though when he's Battle Cat, he likes being Battle Cat. He's like, all right, I'm a macho big cat. When he's turned back into Cringer, he's like, oh, that sucked. You know, that was too intense for me. Yeah. I just want to eat and take a nap.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I mean, handling control issues and conflict can be like that too.
What do you mean?
Well, I can see how if you get all nerdy and read some classic philosophy and start to make a lot of presentations, and you try to become a clear and passionate and convincing storyteller. And yeah, so maybe you're like a battle cat in a presentation situation, right? Uh-huh. But do you want to always be someone that's so controlling of a message? And
thank you. That's exactly it. When we were at Kids Read Comics last year, we were all having dinner together at that Mexican restaurant, remember? Right after the show?
Yeah.
And there was somebody there who previously had only known me through the podcast that I do. And he expressed surprise. He was taken aback at how quiet I was sitting at that table. Mm-hmm. He's like, this is the quietest I've ever heard you, Jersey. I'm like, that's probably because the only time you ever hear my voice is when I'm doing a podcast and I'm in presentation mode, you know?
Yep.
And I said, and like, I don't want to, there's like a whole bunch of really awesome artists here. I don't want to bogart the conversation and take control of everything. You know, I want to listen to you guys. That's why I put on this show, is so I can hang out with a bunch of cool cartoonists. You know, yeah, I don't want to be that guy all the time, right? Not to compare myself to any kind of a superhero like Battle Cat, but philosophically speaking.
Those modes can complement each other.
Right.
And whereas if you did try to level up and always be in that mode, you would be kind of a demon, kind of a creepy, creepy controlling kind of. I don't know.
Watch Susie Orman.
Pop culture. Who's that?
I'm joking. I love Susie Orman.
That's cool.
But the only time we see her is when she's in presentation mode. And if she acts that way all the time, yeah, it would be kind of demonic to see.
Exactly. But those modes can complement each other. So even if you're doing that in the context of you're trying to do some visual design or some storytelling, storyboards or whatever you're doing for your creative pursuits for someone else. Mm-hmm. And it's probably those different modes can help each other. Let's say you are going into conceptualist mode, where you really have to listen to and then express some concrete thing that then that client can interact with or chew on. well, then you're probably going to have to leave that mode and go into more of the listening, helpful, piece it together facilitator, which in the end, that will, both modes will help you get to the end result.
We've talked about Maslow in the past.
Oh, yeah.
There's a great talk by Joe Campbell. Again, I'm going to bring up Campbell. Take a drink. Where he talks about, what is it? Is it like the seven needs for human's well-being? Well, I got to look it up now.
I am looking it up right now. It is a pyramid. Yeah.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Here we go.
Yep. It's a set of five.
Right. So psychological safety, love, belonging, esteem, right?
And then self-actualization.
Yeah. And like the four bigger parts of the piece, it's done as a pyramid. I'll link to it, the Wikipedia page in the show notes. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Campbell talks about, and this is one of the reasons I like him so much and like his speeches so much, he says, like, when you look at those four bottom rungs of the hierarchy of needs, he says, this is exactly what these are exactly the things that don't inform a creative person's life. Like self-esteem, oh boy, confidence, achievement, respect of others, friendship, family, intimacy, security of body, employment, resources. These aren't the things that drive somebody spiritually mad and makes them create a great work, right? What drives them is something else, something inside of them, this inner zeal or whatever, as Campbell calls it. And when that inner zeal is working, when you're driven by something like that, you don't even notice if you look foolish or not. If you haven't experienced that, you've known somebody like that, where they're not intentionally wearing different colored socks to make a statement or be fashionable. They just forgot. They didn't notice because they are so gripped by something that's so important to them that everything else, security, prestige, even, you know, taking care of their body, that's all fallen by the wayside because they're gripped by this thing. Some people are going to say, like, oh, well, that's inspiration, that's genius or something. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think this is a state that we can actually achieve, like meditation, like a transcendent meditative state. I think when we are, when we carefully deduce or investigate what we enjoy, and we'll get more and more to the heart of it. I wasn't 8 years old and put down Crisis on Infinite Earths number 3 or whatever. No, I was 10. I didn't put that down and say, I'm going to be a cartoonist and know that I was gripped by spiritual madness. I just knew that I thought it was really cool and I liked to do it. The spiritual madness didn't come until later when I investigated further and deeper and I kept getting all these secrets and they kept driving me crazy, right?
Yes.
I don't know. Did I just say a bunch of nonsense?
No, yeah. I identify with that.
But I think that, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs kind of, like, all can be directly correlated to a desire for control, right? So, like, you look at...
Oh, sure.
Breathing, food, water, sex, sleep, homeostasis, excretion. Oh, man, they're not pulling any punches with this, are you, Maslow?
nope.
Security of body, employment, resources, morality, the family, health, property. These are all things that we try to have control over, right? I also think of that Calvin and Hobbes comic strip where Calvin has one of those watering canisters and there's a flower in the ground. And Calvin is taunting the flower with the canister of water. And he's like, you want water, huh? But you can't have it. I get to decide who gets water and who doesn't. And then it starts raining. And then he just looked kind of bummed out. And I remember I was reading one of the annotated Calvin and Hobbes collections and Watterson wrote underneath The Illusion of Control. I should jot that one down too and put it in the show.
Yeah, that's a really good one, yeah.
All these things, like these people say, like, oh, well, you guys lead a scary life because you're creative people and there's not as much job security there. I'm like, Where does this job security you speak of exist? I've worked many jobs where there was no sense of security. So these all come out of like playing on our desire to control things. And the weird part is when you're gripped by something, you forget about that and it's okay to look foolish. It's okay for people to think you did a poor job at something, because what's more important to you is that long-term thing of not even achieving, but engaging with something. Does that sound fair?
Yeah. So whatever you look at it as, the satisfying part of making and creating, yeah, which could be the process, or both the process and the results, yeah, what have you. any one of those, that's interesting. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is another interesting thing to consider when maybe you're having a bit of a conflict with someone else's idea of control, and think about, well, what's sort of going on here, and why? What are they getting at? What are they really expressing? You know, because one thing, artists deal with this when you go to seek critique and feedback. And of course, one of those times could be when you're presenting something to a client and you're getting feedback. And so your relationship with control will, you know, dictate a bit about how do you feel about the kind of things you're hearing, and how are you channeling it a bit? Because maybe it's time to facilitate. Maybe it's time to be quiet. Depends on you, depends on them, because maybe they're saying things that are totally inaccurate, that just show they want to look smart, and they wanted to pick a different solution or something. And
how many times have you been in that situation, Rob, where you just kind of kept mum because you knew that this conversation was about somebody else feeling smart and they needed that right at that moment? And this wasn't the time for you to shut them down,
no,
or to prove them wrong. This is about letting them have that moment. And this isn't passive aggression. This is by no means passive aggression. This is reading another human being, realizing what that human being is undergoing at that particular moment, and letting them have that moment so that you can continue to be two human beings and not fight over a bone that doesn't matter.
Exactly. Because, yeah, to me, I'm motivated about the end result, or I try to be. And that moment, trying to engage in it in some kind of way that would cause that to be more of the purpose of the meeting, as opposed to moving on
that's exactly it. It would totally derail what you're trying to achieve by fighting over such a petty little thing.
Yep.
And again, that's why I got mad at myself when I acted aggressively towards that other person. Was that moment was about that other person. This is where, like, using a little bit of psychology and just and a little bit of empathy, and realizing that people are coming from a lot of weird directions at you. And I don't know where this guy's coming from when he said that thing. A, don't take it personally. B, realize that maybe this moment is about him just trying to gain the perception of control over the situation. Let him have it. And then go back to doing the thing that's important to me, rather than trying to win some kind of petty victory with somebody in a room. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why I was disappointed with myself, because it wasn't about being big or being magnanimous or having everybody quietly understand that I'm the better man. That doesn't matter. Who cares? What cares is, what is the thing that we're trying to accomplish here today? Is it getting done? And I let myself get distracted by this moment of somebody acting or me perceiving somebody saying something petty to me, and then me responding in kind.
I've done that too, though. I mean, we're all human, and we're going to see certain things as threats once in a while.
Yeah.
And sometimes, yeah, I respond to a threat with, I'm ready to get into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, what can you do?
No, you can't. I mean, like I said,
learn from it,
I let myself feel bad about it for about 5 minutes, but then I quickly jumped in there and said, don't do this. You know, don't be a big baby. Don't be a juvenile, you know, pouty 15-year-old who's not going to put on Pearl Jam and just feel sad. You know, be a man about this. Recognize that it didn't turn out the way you had hoped it would have turned out. Don't let that happen again. You know, if you're truly sorry, you're not going to let it happen again. There you go. How about that? Don't feel bad. Just fix it.
Exactly.
So yeah. But I just thought it's funny that we chose this week to talk about this control topic, because it was right hot on the heels of that experience where I didn't feel like I was at my, it wasn't my finest hour. But again, nobody probably even noticed.
It's yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I know every single week, I mean, I'll have high points and low points with that, because I do a lot of things where it's collaborative design, and there's the, depending on the, you know, clients and situations, there could be so many people involved, and maybe some of I'm tuned into some of their ways of learning and communicating, but not everyone, because there could be always new people coming in depending on how big the organization is and whatnot. Yeah, so you're just never going to be ready for that's another this is so funny. This topic's funny because it gets so intertwined in meta, and part of that's style and how I'll, you know, I know how I'll tangle things together, but that's my relationship with control. Is I know that, well, that's, yeah, there's going to be some misses in there too, because there's just so much of it getting integrated all the time.
That leads me to another thing that's been kind of, you know, chafing my skid plate. And I posted about this on the Evil Jersey Twitter feed. I don't know if anybody listening to this knows about this, but I do this. I have a special Twitter feed for a character that I invented called Evil Jersey. It came out of the Art and Story podcast that I used to do, where I would play devil's advocate for a topic, or I'd try to debate the opposing side of the topic, just out of trying to like sort of bone up on my oratory skills, right? If I'm gonna talk about subjects, I should be able to try to fight both sides of it. Well, my co-hosts on the show, I guess I did such a good job in one of those episodes with fighting for the side that I was actually against, that they said they wanted to beat me up. They were really angry with me for doing such a good job debating the other side. So they coined it that character Evil Jersey. So it's just Evil Jersey on Twitter, and what that Twitter feed is for is he just gives the absolute opposite advice. First of all, he's a guru. He just doles advice.
Of course he's a guru.
Exactly. I mean, he's my opposite number. So he's a guru. Yeah. He doesn't follow anybody back. He follows zero people. He's not there to follow. He's there to lead. And all of his tweets are just advice that he is doling out to the masses. And it's all exactly the opposite of how I feel about the world. So it's kind of a fun exercise looking
that
to...
Is,
It's a fun exercise to like look at the world through his lenses, you know, and also it's a great catharsis for me when I see somebody doing exactly the opposite of what I think is right on Twitter. And then I go, oh, that's good for Evil Jersey. He's going to say, do what that guy did, you know,
of course.
And it's also kind of based on the idea of the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. I don't know if you ever heard of that book or read it.
No. What's that?
It's a series of fictional letters between two demons. And it's an older demon teaching a younger demon how to corrupt a human being. And it's written in this kind of like early 20th century, late 19th century kind of prose style, affectionately yours, your dear Uncle Screwtape. And it's very sweetly written, but it's all about how to ruin a human being. And it's sort of like Lewis using the opposite point of view to prove his case for Christianity.
Oh, okay.
Learning how to behave by showing how not to behave, kind of thing. It's a great book, though. Whether or not you're a Christian, it's lovely. Lewis's writing is just—I adore his writing style. But anyway, I posted on the Evil Jersey Twitter feed. I should just pull it up because I want to get the quote right, because I was pretty happy with it. Twitter.com/EvilJersey. Did you not there know about
no,
this?
No, I knew about it, but I don't follow him because he's a dick.
He says, demand absolute consistency from yourself as well as others. The internet is the last place one should find human beings. And this goes to your point a moment ago about, you know, you fall off the horse sometimes. We try to be as good at this stuff as we can be, but we're human beings. We're inconsistent. And one of the things that really chafes me every once in a while is when somebody tries to catch me in an aha moment on the internet where, oh ho, Jersey, you just said this, but 2 years ago you said that. I gotcha. To which I say, yeah, but I'm a human being. I get to change my mind. And B, I don't even know what you're referring to. It could be that you're misquoting me. C, you may be misunderstanding what the true meaning of what I was saying was in the first place. And D, get off my back, Jack.
Exactly.
I get to do what I want to do. But it kind of comes to this kind of idea that people, I think this is an altogether human thing, and therefore it's a forgivable thing. but it can be annoying to come up against. I don't blame the internet for this. I think it's a human thing. Is we make cartoon cutouts of the people that we know and the people that we follow and the people that we admire and respect. And when I do this myself, when I became friends with Dan Mishkin, who was one of the writers who made me want to be a cartoonist. So he started out as being a hero of mine. And when I had dinner with him the first time, I did all the sweats and like, oh my God, I'm having dinner with Dan Mishkin. I can't believe it. And now I talk to the guy on the phone regularly and awesome. Good for me. Hooray. Victory of the internet. But the first time I heard the man swear, the first time I heard the man say a bad word, I was like, oh, no, no, you don't do that. You're the guy who wrote all those wonderful children's stories that I grew up on and loved so much. You can't possibly. Wait a second. He's a grown man. He's married. He has children. That implies other things, you know.
Exactly. People are people. And the whole human experience. It's helpful to try to tune into that on with both your relationship of control for what you do and then also, you know, sharing it with other people. Because that's one of the awesome things like that I am so drunk and in love with user experience design is that's what it's all about, is like really trying to get into how people see things, how we can express things in a way so they come across and can be used in a way that you intended. But and even some of that has a ton of control related to it, because you can totally build stuff that has certain motivations that people come up with their different motivations and they use it for different, you know, purposes. Happens all the time on the internet, you know?
That's funny. I wonder if, see, this is a chicken or egg thing. I don't know if this is comics as a medium informing me or me being attracted to comics in the first place because of my disposition. But one of the things that I love about comics is there's a certain degree of control that we have over the reading experience. We can exert a control, but ultimately we're not in full control. The reader gets to decide how to do things. And there's nothing I love more than a page that can be read in multiple ways. If three different readers can interpret the page in three different equally valid ways, oh my gosh, that is what gets me, you know, into, you know, eyes rolling in the back of my head kind of ecstasy. I don't know. I don't know if that's something where I don't know who informed what there, but yeah, like that would be my definition of control, is that it's an implicit thing and it's very subtle and it has a guiding kind of feel to it, but it's not, it's open to the moment. It's open to interpretation. It's open to other people's feedback and it can roll with that. It allows for inconsistencies. Did I do it?
I think you did it.
Double fisted shake over the shoulder.
Yeah, that rocked.
Look, can I just take a moment to congratulate us? Okay, you sure. You got back from a weekend flight out of state to go interview at a bunch of places.
Oh yeah.
you were away from your family. I don't know how much sleep you got, but sleeping in a hotel is never fun. I've got a cold. A bad one. I'm losing my voice. And we came in here, got in front of the mics, and we said, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about control? I don't really have any notes, Rob. That's okay. I don't either. And we just did that.
Yeah, we just did that.
I'm taking the liberty to high five. I think we deserve a high five for that.
All right, cool.
And so we did it. So this is where I'm going to say, I'm going to put this episode up early. I'm going to put this up on Thursday instead of Friday because I want to give people one last chance.
Oh, cool.
If you found this stuff useful, helpful, interesting, entertaining, a great way you can thank us and support our efforts to do this show is to go to leanintoart.com/workshops. We have a new live workshop coming up at the end of March, March 28th, if I'm not mistaken, at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And that is called Absolute Consense. I'm going there now. I'm going to leanintoart.com/workshops, everybody. You should too.
Yep. It's a workshop put on by Tyler James of Comics Tribe and TylerJamesComics.com and comics like Over. And I actually, what's funny is I tabled next to that gentleman at my first comic convention.
Really?
Yeah.
This guy?
No.
he was a bit of a douche.
Exactly. He had too much feedback for me. I was tabling wrong. No, actually, he was awesome. And yeah, that's why I was like, I got to follow this guy on Twitter and connect with him. And yeah, I learned a ton sitting next to him at my first convention.
And yes, so he's leading a workshop for us. This man knows what he's talking about. He's doing a hour and a half workshop called Absolute Consense, 50 strategies to double your fun, triple your contacts, and quadruple your profits at your next comic book convention. You guys will notice we did not intersperse these ads in the middle of our conversation. We saved it for the end because mm-hmm. we know that this is the point where you're leaning back in your chair going, oh, that was a satisfying podcast. This is your after dinner mint now, is to say, hey, did you like that? Well, here's this one is really going to cleanse your palate. You go to Absolute Consense at leanintoart.com/workshops. Early bird pricing at the time when this episode goes live, you only got 24 hours left. It's $42 for an hour and a half workshop where you're going to get 50 strategies to double your fun, triple your contacts, and quadruple your profits at your next comic book convention. After Friday, March 9th, the price is going to go up to $65. Mm-hmm. So it's going to go up by a full 50%. So last chance to sign up at the early bird pricing. And let me tell you, as a guy who learned a lot of this kind of consense the hard way, expensively.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many things that you could lose far more than $45 to $65 on besides a really awesome workshop put on by an excellent presenter and a very experienced guy who cares a ton about managing those details.
Yes. Yeah. That's an important one to underscore too. This is a guy who actually does, he gives a lot about this. I said this on Twitter and I'll say it here. Convention costs can rack up, add up fast. $150 to $300 for a table. Okay. Then you've got your hotel stay, $70 to $150 a night, right? Okay. We'll stay at a friend's house. Well, you still got travel costs. You got gas or flight costs, costs. Food costs add up fast. Well, I'll just shop at Trader Joe's and I'll just fill up a couple sacks of stuff. Where are you going to keep it, pal? You got to keep that stuff in the little mini fridge, even if they have one. Unless you're staying with friends, unless somebody else is buying your food, you're going to wind up spending anywhere between $600 to $1,000 just to go to a simple three-day convention.
Totally.
I haven't even brought up book costs yet. Printing your books, getting your signage, table dressing, all that other stuff, getting buttons made. All this stuff adds up so fast that before you know it, you spent $1,000 to $2,000. So that's where I wish, and I know this is going to sound like a really crude, corny ad, but I don't mean it to, because I sincerely feel this way. I wish I would have been able to take something like this workshop 10 years ago when I was first getting into the conventioning scene.
Exactly. I mean, if it's crass to do it, then so be it. Like, this is why we're doing Lean Into Art, is that we're trying to build this really... really helpful body of material that we really believe in. Yeah. And this is definitely another helpful module that we really believe in.
So, yep, that's at leanintoart.com/workshops. So then we can move away from that and say, is there anything else that you wanted to point people at, Rob?
No, not too much going on. I mean, as you mentioned, I'm... out and about and looking for the next gig and all that kind of stuff. So, yep, juggling a lot of those kind of life activities. So I can't wait to have some more creative project things to release. So my, what'd you call that? The creative madness or?
I'm quoting Campbell when I say spiritual madness. And I know
spiritual madness.
That's a loaded term because it does, you know, spiritual is kind of a funky word with a lot of people nowadays. But whenever Campbell talks about it, he's always talking about just being seized by something that's like, you know, one could argue that comics is sort of religious to me, right? It's a sacred thing that you better not poop on in front of me because I'm going to get mad. Right. So in that context, I accept the word spiritually mad.
Yeah. For tonight, for how, as you pointed out, how spent I am and whatnot. whatever. Spiritual. Fair enough. Spiritual madness. I totally got the spiritual madness. And can't wait to finish various things working on. So.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm excited to get back to it. And I love that we pulled it off another podcast too. So,
I want to make one more note about something. this is a minor thing. It's much more important that you go to leanintoart.com/workshops, but I'm running a commission sale. I don't know if anybody even knows who listens to this show that I do comics art in addition to teaching it and talking about it. But on comicsaregreat.com/sale, I'm selling 40 pieces of custom art, doing ink sketches, designing social media avatars, and even full color illustrations at a fraction of what I would charge a client for this stuff. And putting up limited quantities, limited time available. If people want to go there and get something, you're getting high quality art at a very reasonable price. And that's all I'll say about it. And we can link to it in the show notes if people
can. Highly recommend that as well.
That'd be really great. I realized when I was talking to you last time, I haven't done commissions for social media avatars in 7 years. There wasn't social media at that point. I was doing forum avatars.
Sure.
For money and prizes.
Yeah, people send cassette tapes in the mail.
Yeah. they had to send an SASE, if anybody remembers those.
No.
A self-addressed stamped envelope?
Oh, self-addressed stamped envelope. Oh, yeah, that's a funny acronym.
Remember going way back. That's going back like 20, 30 years.
Mm.
Okay, well, thank you, Rob. Thank you for bringing, even when you're exhausted, you are a sharp, sharp tack, dude.
it's just from hanging out with folks like you, man. Keeps me needing to be sharp. Therefore I'm sharp.
Watch yourself. Watch it. Oh
yep.
Okay, so until next time. Thanks, everybody, Jersey. Until next episode, which will be a video episode, I have been Jersey Droz of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.